The last time we looked at Cologne was around the year 1100. Now we're 100 years further on, and the city area of Cologne had expanded again in 1180. Time to take another look at the city and see what it looked like around the year 1200. More about this right after the intro. This time, we want to look at Cologne around 1200. I'll just pick out a few elements for you. We can start in the classic way, as we've done before in previous episodes where we took a look at the city. We'll start in the north of the city. In ancient times, in Roman times, we had the main north-south road to Neusia. There were Roman graves on both sides of the road around 1100. The gravestones had largely disappeared, of course, buried underground by the ravages of time, or, as was often the case, already reused for other purposes as building blocks in new buildings, like the entrance portal of the monastery church of St. Cecilia, whose archway consists of joined Roman stone slabs. However, not much has changed around here in the year 1200. Everything here is largely surrounded by fields that the surrounding farmers cultivate, but there's one small difference. A large, mighty stone wall surrounds the fields to the north, but not quite yet finished. Workers are in the process of completing this wall. Cologne expanded for the second time in the 12th century in 1179/80, to be precise. However, the Eigelstein Gate, which is still located here today and which gave the district its name, did not yet exist. The construction of the large medieval city wall involved several construction phases. In 1179, the aim was to quickly create facts with an earth moat and earth rampart with wooden palisades. Here in the year 1200, these are now largely replaced by stone walls. The large double-towered city gates, made out of stone like the Eigelstein Gate, almost castles in terms of their size, of which three still exist today, like Eigelstein Tor, Hadern Tor, and Severins Tor, were the last to be built. At that time, Cologne was building a total of 12 land-side city gates in different sizes and forms, which is an exaggeration to say the least, to have 12 city gates. Sure, some were smaller, as said, but even for a large city like Cologne, the number 12 was simply excessive, especially from a military point of view. Every gate is a possible weak point through which enemies could invade the city. The people of Cologne probably wanted to do justice to the Christian number 12 as a holy city, as Holy Cologne, Sancta Colonia. There were 12 tribes of Israel in the Old Testament. Jesus, who gathered 12 disciples around him and who were worshipped in many places in Cologne as well, and in the Revelation of John, we learn that the heavenly Jerusalem also has 12 gates. So the people of Cologne back then probably wanted to emulate this. This semi-circular stone ring, which enclosed a total of 400 hectares, will be 9 kilometers long. This made Cologne one of the largest fortress cities of its time in Europe in terms of area and population at the time. Cologne was the largest city in the empire. Let's go a little further into the city. We head south along Eigelstein Street towards the cathedral. We quickly notice that it's not just the city walls on the outskirts of Cologne that are under construction. The whole city seems to be a building site. As we walk towards the city, we see the newly built Maccabi Monastery facing the Rhine. The nuns here, headed by their abbess, are currently having their brand new convent church extended. But construction noise can also be heard everywhere else, because building is going on everywhere in Cologne. On churches and monasteries, yes, but also on the many stone houses being built by rich, long-distance traders and influential ministerials. Once we arrive in the town, we notice the hustle and bustle of the people living here. Carts, whether pulled by animals or people, move through the narrow streets. They are loaded with building materials for Cologne's numerous construction sites, but also with fine goods or everyday materials. Here in the north of the city, the Archbishop of Cologne has his own district, so to speak. The Bishop's Palace, St. Maria ad Gradus, and the residences of the cathedral canons form a protective cocoon around the city's defining building, Cologne Cathedral, the old Cologne Cathedral. Because the Romanesque Cologne Cathedral, the previous predecessor building for today's Cologne, Gothic Cologne Cathedral, was in its final bloom here in the first half of the 13th century. It is considered one of the cathedrals in the empire, alongside the great imperial cathedrals in Speyer and Worms, which once used it as a model. Countless pilgrims queue outside the entrance to see the shrine of the three holy kings inside the cathedral, then as now. Only back then the primary goal was also a religious one. People hope for personal salvation from the relics for themselves or their loved ones. But the members of the cathedral chapters were a grumble. The cathedral with its 9th century core and a double choir, each ended of which is elevated from the nave, does not really allow a steady stream of visitors to pass through the church building easily. Perhaps it should be done like these new chic French churches that the cathedral canons had heard of. So it comes to no surprise that at the beginning of the 13th century, the Cologne Cathedral chapter has been considering building a new cathedral. For some time, the idea had already been floated here at the beginning of the 13th century, as I said, but it would take until the middle of the 13th century before the idea was put into practice. The cathedral chapter of Cologne Cathedral is actually another interesting topic that we need to look into. This original community of priests or monks, which was based here in Cologne Cathedral, had amassed a great deal of secular power in the meantime. In organizational terms, they were independent of the archbishop and managed their own affairs with their cathedral. With numerous estates and donations, and above all, thanks to the many high-ranking noble members, these 72 members of the cathedral chapter had become a political power in their own right, alongside the archbishop and the emancipating citizen community. But more on that another time, promise. But let's move on. Despite the hustle and bustle of Cologne's narrow streets, you shouldn't think that everyone was free to do as they pleased. Public and, to some extent, private life was strictly controlled in many ways, even more so, in my personal opinion, much more than today. Many trades required membership of a guild. Merchants organized themselves in guilds as well. Guilds were tightly organized with numerous rules for their members. In guilds, for example, such as the important Wool Weavers Guild, there were separate courts, separate committees. The defense of the city was also partly organized here at this time. Religious activities such as processions in the city on public holidays were undertaken together, and most importantly, people controlled each other in a guild in terms of prices, quality, and quantity of the goods they produced or sold. Total market surveillance and control. No one was allowed to weave wool unless they were a member of the guild of the wool weavers. No problem, right? So you just become a member of a guild, just like you become a member of a gym. No, think again. The guilds themselves decided who they accepted and who they did not. And not indefinitely they let people join their ranks. And not just anyone could join. Anyone who was not a Christian, such as Jews, was not allowed to join a guild. This meant that they could not work as weavers, turners, or felt hat makers. If you were a woman, you could usually forget about it. But from the perspective of the time, Cologne was very progressive, to put it cautiously, because not all, but some guilds did accept women. And 4 guilds in Cologne were staffed exclusively by women. This made Cologne almost unique in medieval Europe alongside Paris and Zurich in Switzerland, today's Switzerland. It was completely normal for women in the Middle Ages to pursue professions, work as craftswomen, or be gainfully employed in other ways. The woman as a pure housewife is an invention of the 19th century and the 1950s in the Western world. But, as already mentioned, they could not always join a guild, neither did they always have a leading position. But there were cases of that in Cologne, and as I already mentioned, there were 4 women's guilds in Cologne. These were the yarn makers, the gold spinners, the silk makers, and the silk spinners. In the 13th century, we can assume that there were around 20 guilds in Cologne in total. In the late Middle Ages, the number increased again. So if you're a member of Chamber of Industry and Commerce or something like that, and you think you're treated not the right way nowadays, well, think of the Middle Ages again and how it was back then. Nowadays, Article 12 of the German Constitution guarantees complete freedom of choice of profession. Of course, for some professions you need training or degree, but in general, all professions are open to you. But of course, you shouldn't talk down guilds completely and have the narration of a dark, bad medieval era. The impression should not be given at all. That would be an arrogant view from today's modern perspective. At the time, the guilds certainly had their uses, if you were a member of them. Those who were organized together in a guild had a greater political voice, greater economic security. They gave each other protection when dealing with customers, but also against the local ruler. And in general, the guild, which was organized as a brotherhood, was also charitable. If the weaver fell ill, for example, or died, the guild would collectively ensure that his widow and children were helped and that they did not simply fall into poverty and destitution because there was no public health care, insurance, or state widow's pension until very recent times. People knew each other, they helped each other, a typical Cologne thing. Guilds were a formative element of Cologne's history. This system was only abolished, listen up, it was only abolished in Cologne in 1798, when the city was under French occupation. Until then, this medieval economic system, and by medieval I really mean a value-neutral but epochal term, had endured many, many hundred years. Let's continue our look at Cologne after a short break. The 13th century will have a continuous line of conflict as far as Cologne city history is concerned. Who owns the city? A question that has been constantly asked in the city since at least 1074 and has been tested again and again by all power-conscious parties in the city. In 1074, for example, it was presumably just a small group of Cologne merchants, far distant merchants, who caused a brief uproar in the city, but the situation had changed in the meantime. For the richer citizens of the city, long-distance trade was of course still important, but they no longer necessarily went on voyages themselves. In other words, the owner, the long-distance trader himself, would pack the goods onto his boat and sail them to England, personally attended the sale in London, and then return home. No, he did not do that anymore. Of course, some people still did that, but not the rich long-distance traders at the top. They preferred to leave that to their younger sons or confidants. With the wealth they had amassed in this way, sometimes for generations, they now acted in particular as real estate dealers, landowners who rented out houses, or worked even as bankers. This gave rise to veritable patrician dynasties in Cologne who referred to themselves as the dynasties, or in German, die Geschlechter. This handful of families, later a tight circle of just 15 families in the late Middle Ages, occupied the seats of power in the city that could be occupied by citizens. Be it the Riecherzeche, the brotherhood of the rich, be it the positions in the wards to exercise power at a neighborly level, or the collegiate of jurors, which advised in court on behalf of the archbishop, but also carried out many administrative tasks in the city. The interesting thing is, these rich citizens of Cologne, however much money they may have, at this time in the first half of the 13th century, they were legally just that, citizens, or in some cases even unfree. But this is of little concern to the rich mere citizens of Cologne, as they accumulated wealth, they increasingly imitated the nobility, without being nobility themselves. Although some of them would later, yes, become nobles, they were not yet nobles at the time we're talking about. So what do I mean with they started to imitate the nobility? Well, wealthy Cologne citizens began to donate money for churches being built, or chapels, work of art, and charitable institutions such as hospitals. This was something that had previously only been done by the nobility or high clergy that often came from nobility as well. Now the wealthy citizens built imposing stone townhouses for themselves, like little palaces, while the rest of the population continued to live in wooden or half-timbered houses. Anyone who worked as a long-distance trader had to be prepared for anything. Natural disasters such as storms, but also attacks by pirates or competitors, or injustice suffered in distant foreign lands. Every long-distance trader had experienced all of this at least once in their own life and career. So, long-distance traders were not snobbish and spoiled wimps, as the Bishop Anno-friendly chronicler Lambert of Hersfeld in 1070-something in the late 11th century once called them. Due to their long journeys, long-distance traders were weather-tested and also experienced in battle. This military tradition continued over the generations in those families. The richest citizens of Cologne now even had around 1200, they already had knight's armor made for them. They fought with swords, shields, and lances, and even created their own coat of arms. In Cologne, knights tournaments were now therefore held repeatedly throughout the Middle Ages, particularly on the Altmarkt Square. This kept people, the rich people in Cologne, in training. I can only emphasize it again at this point, as we have already covered this topic in an earlier episode. At a time when armies often only consisted of a few thousand fighters, a city like Cologne with 40,000 inhabitants was a military power that should not be underestimated. Now, perhaps not offensively, but above all defensively, with even the richest citizens being knights. With a mighty city wall, and around 10,000 to maybe 15,000 men that were capable to wear arms, Cologne was always able to successfully defend itself against foreign enemy forces until 1794, so for many, many centuries. The coordination process between citizens and the archbishop was not always straightforward. That's the other big topic. It is often a back and forth. Remember the podcast episodes on the German throne controversy. The citizens of Cologne took advantage of the power vacuum in the archbishopric to seek their own autonomy from the city rulers. And in general, my own narrative in this podcast also runs the risk of portraying a continuous triumph of the Cologne citizens, starting with the failed uprising against Anno II in 1074, the successful expansion of the city in 1106 and 1179, when the citizens of Cologne could do that without the approval of the archbishop, and so forth. But, of course, there were also setbacks. Yes, there was the Richardzeche, the Brotherhood of the Rich, and the Collegiate of Jurors, but the former was still an unofficial body of Cologne's wealthiest citizens, and the latter was an instrument of power of the city ruler, the archbishop. But an official political organ of the citizens of Cologne that they only controlled, that did not yet exist. So around at the beginning of the 13th century, the citizens came up with the idea. It had been around in Italy for a long time, and Cologne merchants had good connections to Italy and heard of that idea, probably. They had the idea of having a city council, elected representatives of the citizenry who met regularly to discuss and decide on certain matters concerning the city. And in 1216, Cologne, the citizens of Cologne, the wealthy citizens of Cologne, saw their chance. In the midst of the German throne dispute, they took the plunge and established a Cologne city council for the first time since Roman times. But the joy about that was short-lived, because in the same year, Engelbert from the dynasty of Berg was elected as the new Archbishop of Cologne, a power-conscious man who immediately put an end to these independent activities. The first Cologne City Council, therefore, did not even survive a year and dissolved itself again at the behest of the new city ruler. The cityscape of Cologne in the first half of the 13th century and beyond is largely characterized by narrow alleyways and streets. In the core of the city, the former Roman settlement area, the straight course of the streets has often been retained. Outside this area of around 100 hectares, which only made up 1/4 of the total area of the city now, things look very different. Here the roads from points of interest such as churches or important public buildings take the shortest route to the next point of interest, like a city gate for example. Of course, these are no longer checkerboard roads like the Romans did. None of these streets are straight, nor do they meet another street at a right angle, despite the many street breakthroughs in the 20th century. Cologne's old town has often retained this winding structure, which somehow makes sense. The streets adapted to the needs of the people. People were walking by foot at that time, mostly. So the shortest possible route was the best route. Nowadays, it seems to me, it's often the other way around. People have now to adapt to the street and not the other way around. The housing landscape is largely characterized by wooden houses with several stories. The higher the story, the more it protrudes into the street. As a result, there were streets where the sunlight did not fully reach the bottom of the alley. The archbishop's highest official, the Burggraf, always tried to ensure with a measuring stick in his hand, riding a horse, that an upper story did not protrude too much into the street and obstruct traffic. If the stick nevertheless touched an upper story, the owner was forced to demolish it. So, as being said, the town is largely characterized by wooden houses. Here and there, stone halls belonging to a wealthy middle-class family or a patrician family is dotted around. The numerous churches built out of stone stand out much more clearly from the other sea of houses than they do today in nowadays Cologne. But even today, churches in the old town, such as Great St. Martin, still dominate the cityscape despite the numerous modern high-rise buildings around it. And I really only mean that from an art historical and architectural historical perspective. Imagine spending your whole life in a beautiful but modest wooden house, sharing this space with your family and maybe even your livestock in winter, in the middle of the city, cramped up. For all these people, entering a church back then must have been an experience, something that still comes over us today when we enter a magnificent old church building. High ceilings, stone walls, the vastness of the space, the echo of your own voice and footsteps. The deeply religious people of the time certainly believed that they were very close to heaven on earth in such places of faith. There are relics in every church that are said to have performed miracles in times of a lack of modern medicine or simply the knowledge of effective healing methods. Relics serve as saviors against really everything, and so the people not only queuing up in front of Cologne Cathedral, but queuing up in nearly every religious place in Cologne where relics are located. Did you have a headache? Then go to St. Geryon Church in the northwest of the city. The beheaded man is regarded as a savior against headaches. Funny, I know. Did you want a successful and happy marriage? Head to the northwest as well of the city, to the church of St. Ursula, the Virgin Martyr there is considered the patron saint of successful marriages. Which is a bit odd, because according to legend, Ursula and her supposed 11,000 virgin companions were slaughtered by the Huns under Attila on her hen party. And those who hoped for rain for the fields traveled to the other side of the Rhine, to Deutz, to neighboring Deutz, to ask Saint Heribert for cool water from the sky. But back then, that was the way people dealt with challenges, crises, and opportunities. In a world that was deeply understood and steeped in religion, this was the way to keep things better. It was therefore not surprising that others also wanted to benefit from the salvation of holy relics, and Cologne had plenty of relics on offer for Christian Europe. The former burial grounds were regarded as the burial grounds of the martyrs of St. Ursula and St. Geryon and their thousands of followers. Officially, though, the trade in relics was strictly forbidden. Incidentally, it is still today. Catholics who still do this are threatened with a church penalty and even worse. But if the sale was illegal then, as it is today, how did it happen that many relics with Cologne provenance, nevertheless, made it abroad? And that Cologne got rich with that? Well, of course, many people did this anyway, especially monasteries, churches, abbeys, and bishops themselves, who probably needed additional income for a variety of reasons. But of course, there were also legal loopholes. For example, an elaborate little casket was created for a saint's ankle, for example, beautifully decorated with gold leaf paintings and precious stones around the wooden casket. The precious relic, this priceless item that you could not sell at all, was placed inside of it. As already mentioned, the sale of relics was forbidden, but giving it away for nothing, that was not forbidden. Not even today, by the way. So the deal was as follows. The relic was simply given to the recipient as a gift. Here, you can get that holy relic for free. But, and now comes the but, the recipient had to pay for the expensively decorated casket in which the relic was kept, and at a very significant extra cost, over and above the material and labor cost of that little casket. So, I see what you did there. I hope you understand what I mean. A legal loophole to circumvent the ban on selling relics. And trade, we are there already with that topic. Trade is a good keyword. Let's go to the Altermarkt Square. The Altermarkt, or the Old Market, is one of the two central places of the city. The first one is, of course, the Cathedral and the Bishop's Palace, the second one, the Altermarkt. The Altermarkt fulfills many purposes. It is a place of trade, but also of exchanging news. Newspapers and social media did not yet exist. Some court hearings also took place here, because in addition to the High Court at the Cathedral, there were numerous, from today's perspective, confusing jurisdictions of various courts. Courts in guilds or in the wards, for example. Also, as already mentioned, knights' tournaments were also held here on the square. As crowded as the square may be during Carnival these days in modern-day Cologne, it has long since lost its character as a centuries-old center of the city with a constant hustle and bustle. If you walk across the square today of Altermarkt, you will almost find a cozy area, with wedding parties streaming out of today's town hall or tourists sitting in the numerous restaurants and cafes outside. Until well into the first half of the 20th century, however, the Altermarkt was bustling with activity. However, the town hall that dominates the square to the west today did not yet exist at the beginning of the 13th century, but there was a predecessor building here, the House of the Richardzeche, then called the House of the Citizens. The Richardzeche met here, as did the College of Jurors, whose members were automatically accepted to the ranks of the Brotherhood of the Rich, the Richardzeche. We had already talked about the house in an earlier episode. The house was located directly on the Altermarkt. However, the entrance to it was in the Jewish quarter, directly adjacent to the west and slightly elevated from the square, exactly where the town hall and the associated Spanish building stand today in modern-day Cologne. Which brings us to the question of power. Who actually governs the city? It is now very complex structures of dependencies and overlaps. The civic committees of the wards, so the association of several streets, regulate almost everything in the neighborhood, locally. As already mentioned, guilds also had their own courts as well, where they would regulate their own affairs. inside of their organization as well. The same applies to monks, nuns, canons, and canonesses, who then had to answer to the respective ecclesiastical courts. The archbishop was, of course, formally at the top of the city. However, he is just one man who is dependent on the cooperation of the city's society. He therefore maintained a system of relationships with subjects in the city who carried out his will in the city on his behalf as servants, as ministeriates. These ministeriates became powerful and wealthy people, as the story of Gerhard Unmarz, who we once presented here in the podcast, shows. As the highest judge of the city who presided over the high court, the archbishop usually entrusted the management of this body to his Burggraf. The Burggraf was also assisted by the bailiff. We have already talked about these two offices before. The College of Jurors served as court advisors, an association of men who swore allegiance to the archbishop and were at his service as legal advisors in court, helping to reach a verdict. There were no written laws or records of previous judgments in that time. One had to rely on the memory of the members of the jury and on oral tradition. In addition, there was the Richerzeche, the Brotherhood of the Rich, which was as a semi-legal authority independent of the archbishop and representing the interests of the rich and powerful inhabitants, endeavored to exert as much influence as possible in all public areas of the city. With the establishment of its own city council in 1216, independent of the archbishop, Cologne citizens had also attempted, initially in vain, to create an official, purely governing body for the entire city made by them, the citizens alone. But that already, I told you, failed. But in the long run, in the late medieval time, they would succeed with that. So, you see, the system of government in 13th century Cologne was complex. No one could really claim to have absolute power, let alone was there a clearly structured written municipal order like we have today. Many courts or committees existed side by side with their field of work and claim to power and thus competed with each other over jurisdiction in certain matters. For example, the Burggraf and the bailiff were always constantly fighting who had the right to do what as the right hand of the archbishop in a city, or which court was now in charge to speak a verdict in that case, that court or this court or another court. And the same goes with the wealthy citizens of Cologne. They would argue a lot as well in their own organizations like the Richerzeche. And that will get very, very bloody. And I mean with bloody, not you know what I mean, but really, literally bloody. But the best example, I think, that we already talked about is at the highest level, the struggle over the city's sovereignty between the archbishop and the rich citizens. Who was allowed to conclude treaties with great rulers or foreign powers on the city of Cologne's behalf? Could the citizens simply conclude their own treaty with the emperor? Or did this have to be done officially through the supreme ruler of the city, the Archbishop of Cologne, like in old times? This was something that caused a lot of conflict here in the podcast in recent times. And in the next episode, you will see that the path of the citizens of Cologne to more autonomy and then to the greatest possible independence was not a straightforward one. The 13th century presents us with several archbishops of Cologne who had it really going in pushing back this movement by the citizens to gain more autonomy. They were willing to push back citizens' emancipation efforts as strong as possible, and Archbishop Engelbert was just such a man who entered the political stage in Cologne in 1216. Engelbert was by no means an unknown chief shepherd when he took office. For years already, Engelbert, who came from the powerful Rhineland dynasty of the Counts of Berg, had amassed ecclesiastical offices. This had enabled him to secure a great deal of money and political power. This made him one of the archbishops of Cologne who largely interpreted the office as a secular ruler, more than was usual at the time anyway, being a bishop. You can therefore look forward to the next episode, when we will shed light on his, Engelbert's, interesting biography and that of his dynasty and his personal tragic end. For this podcast episode, I largely used Manfred Grothe's Die Deutsche Stadt im Mittelalter, so the German city in the Middle Ages, as a basis. For individual topics such as the Altarmarkt or the patricians in Cologne becoming knights or the guilds, I was helped by the Große Köln Lexikon, the Great Cologne Encyclopedia, published by Jürgen Wilhelm, which has been written by numerous authors with short but scholarly articles. The online article of the portal Rheinische Geschichte, the Rhenish History portal of the Landschaftsverband Rheinland, was also very helpful. Many thanks to my Patreons for your continued support of this podcast. Thanks this time to Moritz, Ricardo, Lucas and Alexander, who are now new members on Patreon. Thank you very much, and I'm sorry if I pronounced all your names in a very German way. I would also like to thank those who sent me a single donation via PayPal. Many thanks to Klaus, Antje, Miriam, Christian, Manfred, Sabine, Bettina, Silvia, Katharina, Victoria, Maren, Norbert, Christina, Antje again, and Christian for your support. And wow, there were so many of you this time. I'm really glad about it. And here again, I pronounced all your names in German. Sorry. In the end, of course, all this remains here is to say thank you to all of you. Thank you for listening to me and the history of Cologne. So, recommend me further. Stay healthy and safe. And as always, auf Wiedersehen.